Welcome back to SIVO Sisters, where we demystify and diversify the field of anesthesiology, all within the duration of an anesthesia break. And this week is our last installment with our interview with Dr. Amanda Dudek. If you can imagine all the things we do within anesthesiology using our hands, how do you palpate and pulse if you have sensory deficits? How do you intubate or mask someone? If you have motor deficits, how do you navigate a cluttered OR, all the sounds and beeps, if you're having difficulties with your hearing and walking? We're going to jump right in where she shares what attracted her to anesthesiology. Please enjoy.
How did anesthesiology be what won you over of all the areas you rotated?
I realized from that first rotation back experience, I enjoy doing things. I enjoy tangible, immediate feedback. I have ADHD as well. And so that kind of like feeds into that need, that instant gratification need, like that dopamine mining. And so I liked obstetrics and gynecology because there's a tangible result, like reproductive endocrinology, infertility. There's a lot of like thought process, a lot of physiology behind the scenes, but like you get somebody pregnant, like you have something to show for the work that you've done, for like the effort that you've put in. And I liked delivering babies. I liked being in the operating room. As much of a challenge as it was to work with my hands, I liked doing things. That hands-on approach was very much my bag. The sit around a table and the endless, just like internal medicine was painful for me. It was like 6 hours of rounding. Psychiatry, literally just hours a day sitting in a room talking to people. I was like, I like talking to people, but like I cannot do this every day for the rest of forever. So my first experience with interaction was actually on my obstetrics rotation. Because you don't rotate in anesthesia as a med student, oftentimes ever. And even on my surgery rotation, like you don't spend any time with anesthesia unless you like seek them out. And being the weird kid stuck in a wheelchair while on your surgery rotation, I spend a lot of time at the head of the bed talking to the other person who's sitting down in a chair. Because the other thing you don't realize is like being in a wheelchair trying to talk to people who are standing is very uncomfortable. There's a huge height difference. And being a med student, so being like the lowest person on the totem pole in the world, just like, kind of like amplifies that feeling. So I spent a lot of time talking to anesthesia people. And I was like, everybody was friendly. They were doing like 800 things at once, which also feeds in my dopamine need. And their whole focus was making it suck less to be in the hospital. That's what anesthesia as a specialty is. It's like, how can I make it less shitty for you to be here in the hospital today? From starting IVs to making sure pain is managed, to making sure you don't wake up nauseous, to like allaying your anxiety. Like even if you're not using medications, like verbal Versed is a real thing. And that ability to talk with patients and relate with patients from a wide variety of backgrounds, like, hey, you know what? I was so gung-ho on OBGYN. Like I had, like, that was where I was going. I knew the practice model I wanted to be in. Like I knew the area I wanted to practice in. Like, I was so gung-ho on that. And there was a kid who came in as a trauma. I was on OB and the doc I was with for the day, we're having a slow day on OB, got a phone call from one of his colleagues. He's like, I need a hand down in the trauma OR. We walked down and it's this 9-year-old kid who had undiagnosed portal hypertension and just had 30 esophageal varices rupture, blood pouring out of his mouth. And like these two doctors are just calm as cucumbers, keeping this kid alive, mass transfusing, throwing in lines, starting on like a shit ton of drugs. And I was like, hey, you know what? And like the surgeons are working to fix the problem, but somebody has to keep that person alive while a surgeon stabs you back to life. I was more drawn to what the anesthesiologist was doing to manage that patient than what the surgeon was doing. Because I was on my obstetrics rotation and 2 days a week, they would have me follow the anesthesia person because they're like, oh, as OB, you're going to need to know a little something about anesthesia. We have great, really nice anesthesia people here. It was a private practice anesthesia group contracted by the hospitals. These people owe me nothing. You'd be like, you know what? Go home, take the day off, go read something. They could have been that level of business and they weren't. And so my job as the med student was to continuously go to the blanket warmer, just continue getting fresh blankets and putting them down on the floor to absorb the blood so everybody's pants didn't get soaked with blood. I had a job. I was a functional part of a larger team. That for me, I was like, you know what? That's what I want to do every day. I want to make it suck less to be here in the hospital. I want to work with my hands. I want to be bedside with patients. I really hated being in the office. I hated writing progress notes, hated prior authorizations. It takes all the things I didn't like about medicine and I didn't like about healthcare that I got way more than I wanted on the patient side. It removed a lot of those things for me, but gave me all the things I still wanted. And I think the personality of the people, again, that I was working with was such a huge, huge part because I could have done absolutely nothing for 2 days a week, not even had to come into the hospital. Like, they could have made it such a different experience. And so that was like how I got into anesthesia. And they're like, oh, you do things sitting down? Yeah, we can do epidural sitting down. You're going to learn how to do an epidural sitting. You're going to learn how to intubate sitting. You can sit down and start an IV. So although I was on crutches at the time, some of my mobility issues were kind of overcome. And like all the other anesthesia people were sitting. I have some sensory deficits in my hands still. They're like, can you feel for an Arlene? Oh, you can't feel? Well, let's get an ultrasound. And they just normalized all of like, if this is how you need to do something, that's how you're going to do something. Oh, you need to turn the pulse ox up to hear it so that you can hear when somebody desats. You just turn that volume right up. If it's too loud for induction, you just tell everybody to pipe down. Everything about that experience was so uplifting. Like, this is a job I can do every day for the rest of forever. I could enjoy my job. I can function in my job with where I'm at right now. It fed all the little bits of the things I loved and got rid of a lot of the things I didn't particularly enjoy.
Oh, I love that. And I just the focus on what it is you can control. Okay, what else can we do? It forces you to really think broadly. It's very expansive way of addressing an issue as opposed to this narrow-minded sort of woe is me way. It's like you don't get anywhere that way.
Exactly. And I feel like the anesthesia mindset of, yeah, we've got plan A, but everybody rolls into every operating room for every case. You've got a plan B, C, D, E, F. And then if you're all the way down at plan Z, like you have an oh shit backup plan already in your head for every case you're doing. So that nimble thought process that, oh, I want this needle for this. I've seen surgeons like absolutely lose their mind because they don't have a specific retractor that they want. And with anesthesia, oh, I want this. Well, we don't have it. Well, what do we have? Like, how can I accomplish my goals with the tools I have available? And that mindset was just very pervasive in the group that I was. And again, the group I happen to be with, like, I'm sure there are places where it's not want what they want when they want it. But that like whole mindset, that attitude, that just very adapt and overcome personality, that's what won me over. 4 days into my anesthesia week on my OB rotation, I was going into the dean's office. And this is end of October, first week of November of fourth year. I am walking into the dean's office saying, hey, it's your favorite problem child. So I think I want to change the specialty I'm applying to. And they're like, it's November. And I was like, I know. They're like, of the year. They're like, how many interviews do you have? And I was, well, I have 25 OB interviews, but I would like to apply for the anesthesia. And they're like, there's not an anesthesia department in this hospital. They're like, you need a chairman letter. Do we find a way to magically rotate you into the anesthesia department at the main campus 2 hours away? Moving somebody who's intermittently in a wheelchair and needs a handicap accessible apartment to live independently 4 hours away to like get a rotation on short notice. These rotations are already set up. So they're like, okay, have you talked to any of the anesthesia people about this? And I was like, yes, I talked to two. They said that they can make me an anesthesia rotation in the next 3 weeks if that works for you guys. And they're like, we will figure it out. We will make it work. And I didn't have a department chairman letter. The guy who's in charge of the private practice, like I met with him, I had worked with him a couple of times, but he's like, I've never written one of these letters before. What am I supposed to write? And I was like, I don't know, but you can call the dean and see what this is supposed to look like. He's like, I will gladly write you a letter. I have lots of nice things to say about you. He's like, I have no idea what I'm doing. He's like, this may like absolutely blow up your application. Is it kind of late to be doing this? I was like, yes, it is very late to be doing this. I was like, we're going to talk about backup plans and strategically applying for residencies. Because like in the back of your mind, you're thinking, okay, I don't want to go unmatched. Do I need to apply to like some general medicine or like general surgery, like intern years? Try and it would be more challenging for me to go to a 1+3 program than it would be to be at a 4-year program. From like an educational perspective, I really liked the idea of a 4-year program. And of course, like I'm researching all this shit in 4 days. And I was like, okay, what programs are still accepting applications? I think there were 6 in the entire country that were still accepting applications. So I applied to all of them like that day. I sent an email to every single program that I applied to explaining why my application was so late. And why my letters of recommendation were going to be so late, because I'm asking for a letter in November. They're due not long after that. And so it was an experience. I heard back from 3 programs. I interviewed at 4. So 3 people emailed me back. And I was like, yay, a human got my email. The giant void of residency interviews. So I still went on all my OB interviews. I did apply to a couple general medicine, general surgery rotations for intern years. And I applied to 4 categorical anesthesia programs. And I fell in love with one of them. Hardcore fell in love with all of it. I was like, this is the place for me. This is where I will go. I will meet friends that I will have for the rest of my life. I will be successful here. And to know you found that place, but still have no idea if that's where you're going to end up. It's like you submit your rank list and then it's month. What is it? Month and a half, 2 months. As somebody who's gotten used to like planning everything, who's always needed to be like 2 or 3 steps ahead in order to manage the 800,000 balls you have in the air, like that was hell. And then that was the first year that they started to do the SOAP program or whatever. So I still ranked OB programs on my list because I was like, I would rather be at a program for OB, do a year or something, and then reapply for the match again than go unmatched. I found out Monday of match week that I matched somewhere. You know, you have a home to go to, but you're like, I have no idea where this is going to be. I think those were probably the five most nerve-wracking days of my medical career, is knowing you're going somewhere. But like at that point, I didn't even know, am I going to a general medicine in intern year? Am I doing general surgery intern year somewhere? Am I doing a 4-year categorical anesthesia program, or am I going to obstetrics? Because the pathway forward from each of those places looks very different. And then it adds the whole layer of you're going to be living somewhere for a year while also potentially trying to apply to other residencies. I was fortunate. I got the place I fell in love with.
Oh, it's so good.
I would rather be lucky than good any day, and eternally grateful that I ended up where I ended up.
My advice when it comes to the rank order list is I say, honestly, and this is very antithetical to what a lot of folks are being told because of the competitiveness of anesthesia, but I say, hey, rank where you see yourself, honestly. Don't just rank everyone and everybody, because it's still going to be a sense of nervousness when you hear that you match. Because the first thing you're going to do is, oh gosh, is it the program that I was like, eh? You know, so I'm glad it worked out for you. But I would have been like, please don't rank any of those OB programs. You know, you don't want to go there. Like, do what you want, sister.
I had talked to several residents who had changed specialties. So one of them had gone from plastics residency to family medicine. Another one had gone from psych to general internal medicine. And the other one, I'm trying to think who the other one was. She does PM&R now. I don't remember what she started as. My school went out of the way to like find me residents who changed somewhere along the way. One person was 3.5, almost 4 years into a surgical residency when she changed her mind. And the advice she gave me is, she's like, you think right now that you could do anything for a couple years? And she goes, I was literally driving into work every day hoping I would get into a car accident and die. I was so miserable. She's like, I don't ever want you to be there. Just because you've spent a lot of time working towards a decision doesn't mean that decision is right. And you need to be somewhere where you as a person are going to be successful. She's like, if you do obstetrics and gynecology, she's like, are you going to be miserable? I was like, no, but like, I think I'd be happier doing anesthesia. Then she's like, you know what? Go do an intern year. And if you make it through the intern year, and something, the intern year is the worst year of whatever residency you're going to do. So she's like, go and give it a year. Apply again if that's what you think you might want to do. So you've not shut that door on yourself. But she's like, if you go on a couple interviews for anesthesia and you're happy and content doing that OB residency, she's like, stay where you're at. So I think go where you as a person are going to thrive. So was, I think, very good advice. Would I have been miserable doing obstetrics and gynecology? Absolutely not. Am I thrilled that I did anesthesia instead? Also, absolutely yes.
Regarding, you got into anesthesia, you're doing your residency. What advice do you give for those who have different physical impairments? I know for me, just for residency, I was pregnant during a lot of my training. And I saw so dramatically, it was like so weird. People didn't really know how to work with me. People are pregnant all the time, but yet I felt like an alien. Imagine now if you have adaptive devices and assistive devices, things like that. How did you navigate that?
Yeah. So I wasn't told to hide it on the interview trail, but like that was something that wasn't amply advertised. A question I was asked at every interview was, do you foresee any challenges in your practice that can't be overcome by reasonable accommodation? And the answer to that needed to be no. Can you do the job with reasonable accommodation? And then the question becomes, what is a reasonable accommodation? I have sensory deficits in my hands to this day. They're not bad, but they're there. So how the mechanics of how I also have small hands, So how I hold a mask on a patient's face in order to get an adequate mask seal is different from how most people do it. I also can't hold a jaw thrust using my upper body, my arm muscle strength. So what did I do? I spent a lot of time in the sim lab figuring out how can I reasonably and comfortable hold a mask on a patient's face so I can mask ventilate for 10, 15, 20 minutes if that's what I have to do for a patient. And I was encouraged. So they were very open to whatever it is you need to do to be successful. Great. But like nobody could tell me what adaptations I needed to make. So like find what works for you. Don't be afraid to ask for extra time to figure out what that is. And don't be afraid to let people know that I understand that I'm here to learn, but I'm a little bit different of a learner. And this is what I've encountered so far. So if the goal is to successfully mask a patient, maybe you reach for an oral airway sooner. Maybe you're putting in a nasal airway. I found out that a two-handed mask where I rest my forearms on the bed, I put my fingers underneath the angle of the jaw, and I'm using skeletal strength instead of muscular strength to hold that jaw thrust. And then you know what I do? I pop them on the ventilator because both my hands are holding that mask seal and that jaw thrust. So is it cheating? Yes, but not really. It's like it's finding a way to do, focus less on the mechanics of what you're doing and focus more on what the goal is of what you're trying to accomplish. Starting IVs, starting A-lines. When I start my A-lines, I go in at a much shallower angle than anybody else who ever does them. And one of the attendants, like I didn't notice I was doing it. And he goes, you do your A-lines a little weird. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah. He's like, we've always teach like that sharp, super acute angle. And he goes, watch you do the first couple and you were successful. You didn't seem to struggle. You seemed to know what you were doing. And he goes, you do it a little different, but it seems to work for you. And the other thing that I was advised early on was if you're struggling to feel, increase the surface area. So I don't feel for a pulse with one finger. I've got three fingers and I'm tracking what direction is that artery going. I'm also quick to reach for an ultrasound machine. If I can't palpate, you know what? My fingers don't work like everybody else's do. If I need to reach for an ultrasound machine, great. That's what I do. Epidurals. I learned how to do ultrasound guided epidurals, but there are times when it's just impractical or the ultrasound's not available or whatever. Palpating landmarks. And you know, some of that's patient population dependent, but that tactile feedback is very, very important. I don't do continuous pressure because I can't safely and with adequate muscle control do continuous advancement of a TUI while I'm holding pressure on the glass syringe. I do incremental advancement with frequent checking. And is it a little bit slower? Maybe, but I've done enough of them now and I do them all the same way every time that it doesn't take me any longer than any of the other partners in my group to put in an epidural. Those are the kinds of things that are like, focus more on the goal you're trying to accomplish and less on how everybody else is doing it. And I was encouraged by a lot of people along the way. Ask why. When somebody tells you how they do something, ask why. Why do you do it that way? What is the, because you've obviously figured out some advantage for you. Like you have a preference for doing it a certain way for a reason. Sometimes that preference is, oh, that's just how I've always done it. Or that's just how I'm used to doing it. I can't feel anything from the knees down. I can't feel my feet. I can't feel my legs. For me, I get to the OR extra early in the morning. I want no cords, no cables. Nothing should be on that ground because I will trip and I will fall. It's dangerous for me, but it's dangerous for the patient. I pulled out a patient's endotracheal tube. And that's when I realized, hey, dumbass, if you can't feel your feet, pick up all your wires. Like those are the things that somebody who can feel their feet, who can feel that they're stuck on a wire, like that's not an issue for them, but it's an issue for me. So like when I come in, people are like, why? And I was like, everything's coiled up or taped up or like lifted up because that's a me problem. And I recognize that it's a me problem, but this is how I adapt my environment to what it is that I need. So there's going to be so many little things along the way that don't be afraid to let them know that you might need something different and then ask why. You're there to see how a variety of people do it because maybe the way you're doing it is less efficient, less effective, less good for you. Try somebody else's way. I know that there's a learning curve to everything, but ask the why. Why are we doing it this way? Why are we doing it that way? Why are we using this drug over that drug? And know that anesthesia is one of those specialties where it's really beautiful. There are a lot of different ways to get to the same destination. And it's not that one way is more right than the other. They're just different. And so I think finding a place that's supportive of those things. And the other thing that I don't know that I want to say struggled with in residency, but that came up over and over again was all the other residents are interacting with other residents and attendings together on a daily basis. You're very compartmentalized as an anesthesia resident. You're in your room with you and your attending. All the other residents have the opportunity to learn from other residents' mistakes. You have to learn from your own mistakes, which number one, it means you have to make some mistakes. So I encourage you to find a group of people that support you, find your tribe, and talk about the shit you fucked up. Talk about the stuff that goes absolutely sideways. And that was for a brief period after my residency. I stayed on as staff where I did my residency. That was my biggest thing. Like when you come in as an intern, let me tell you about the things that I screwed up so bad that they're funny now. But like in the moment, you are like absolutely mortified. How could this happen? It's things that you just can't believe ever happened to you. And somebody else can learn from the things that you've done wrong. So I feel like you miss out on those extra learning opportunities by design for like how our residency works. Bariatric beds, the sides have to collapse to get into the elevators where I was. I didn't know that. So I was sent up to the ICU to go get my patient to come down to the OR for like an IND of something. They're intubated, they're sedated, they weren't on any vasopressors. They're on like super stable vent setting, 5 a CPAP, 5 a pressure support. Like they're in the ICU because they have a breathing tube. And I got the bed stuck partway through, like I wedged it into the doors. It was physically stuck. And it was me and another intern. It was like, I don't know, our third day of residency, more interns. So we were just proud that we found the ICU and we knew how to get the bed from the ICU to the operating room. We were like congratulating ourselves too early. We like managed to wedge it into the door. And so of course, like the elevator doors are beeping because they've been open too long, but there's something in the way and they're like trying to close and the bed is stuck. I had to climb over this patient in the bed to get into the elevator to help push the bed out of the elevator doors while the other resident was pulling. And somebody from patient transport came along because we had no idea. We're like, oh my God, like this, like, what are you going to do? We're like kind of losing it. Don't neglect the other auxiliary support staff in a hospital, your volunteers, your patient transport, your nurses, your phlebotomists, your respiratory therapists. All these people are valuable resources for you to learn from. And everybody has something to teach you. That was like my big takeaway. So like all the interns, and I was like, you're going to have a moment probably during your first week of residency where you feel like you're the stupidest human being on the face of the planet, where you shouldn't be here. You're never going to figure this out. We all have that moment. Let me tell you about mine. But the only other person who knew about that was like that patient transport and the other intern who happened to be with me. Like had it been 3 days later when I was by myself in the OR, it would have just been me. Like, what are you going to do in that situation? So like, don't panic. Take stock, figure out like what challenge you got to overcome and figure out how you're going to get there. We all make stupid mistakes. And sometimes you like, you think you're going to be clever, you think you're going to do something wonderful and it's going to go absolutely sideways. And like, I've had a couple of those too, but find a place where you're going to be with people you feel comfortable having those conversations with. People in your own class, people in classes above you, people in classes below you, and attendings. Like, find people who are going to support you. And there'll be some everywhere, but some places make it easier than others.
This is the reason why this podcast is created, is to hear these stories. Because anesthesiology, you highlighted it, it's a Lone Ranger sport. You're in your room, you're in your own little universe. Everything else doesn't exist. And it is until we come together and we hear these stories and we're just like, oh my gosh, you too, or oh my gosh, that happened to you, or that happened to me. This is the value. So you couldn't have said it better with finding that support. And thank you for sharing your story. I mean, this is so incredible. Certainly, our listeners are going to gain so much because your story, it's just, we don't hear it. We don't see it. Big shout out to Amber Baruki for the recommendation.
Thank you so much for having me. Something like this would have done so much to kind of like help me along the way. And like my job, I've struggled a lot of it along the way. Anything that I've overcome, if that can help somebody else somewhere along the way, it makes that struggle so much more valuable. So thank you so much for facilitating something like this.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of SIVO Sisters. If you love this episode as much as I did, head on over and rate and subscribe so you don't miss out. New episodes drop every week on a Monday because we all can use a little something, something to get us through the week. Am I right? I'd love to hear more from you on the topics that you want to hear. So let me know in the comments. This is Dr. Peterson signing off. See you next time.